Years now after the first cases of COVID, there's still a whole lot we don't know, including the millions of Americans who say they've suffered with long COVID and long vax, and whether the health effects are a result of infection or injection. Well, joining us now is Dr. Pierre Corey, President and Chief Medical Officer of the Frontline COVID Critical Care Alliance, who also has an entire practice dedicated to patients with long COVID and long vax and other chronic diseases. Welcome to the National Desk, Dr. Corey. Great to see you.
Yeah, thanks, Jen. Good to be here.
So you've treated hundreds of patients with long COVID and long vax. So describe, first of all, what you're seeing right now. Are you still seeing plenty of patients with long COVID and long vax? And tell us the difference between both.
Yeah, so no, we still get a steady stream of patients with both conditions. You know, just at the outset, long vax is far more common than long COVID. In our practice of over 1,000 patients, we would say about 70%. All of their symptoms started temporally associated or right after the vaccine. The difference is, you know, first, let's just define what it is. Although it has a new name, it's not a new disease. It's been described for years. It goes by the name myalgic encephalitis / chronic fatigue syndrome, or MECFS. And that's been around a while. However, it's still poorly understood. We're starting to understand it more now. But the diagnosis is really, founded on a pillar of three main symptoms, which is a new debilitating fatigue, something we call post-exertional malaise, where patients, even after minimal activities or exertion, suddenly will be, you know, their fatigue trebles and all their other symptoms flare up. And then the third is brain fog, which is some amount of cognitive deficit, you know, things from word-finding difficulty, short-term memory, long-term memory, comprehension, and sometimes even disorientation. So it's really fatigue, post-exertional malaise, and then brain fog. And then there's a whole side list of symptoms. And so when you ask what the difference is, I would say they're essentially the same. The kind of the two things that I see a little bit differently is that long vax, they're on average far sicker than long COVID, for sure. And also, long vax seems to improve less with time, whereas long COVID, you can see patients even without specific treatments. You know, they will demonstrate some improvements over time, but long vax much less so.
How long are these symptoms lasting on average?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, in my practice, everyone who sees us has been sick for at least a year and a half. I mean, we have probably a, you know, that practice experience is probably different than the average person out there. I think the patients that come to us are really quite ill and often very debilitated, and they have been sick for a long time. By the time patients find out that they can get care through me or my practice, they often suffer long journeys through the system. They go to these long COVID clinics. Very little care is offered. Very little understanding of the disease is demonstrated. And it's really a shock. The patients are really... they feel abandoned.
I'm sure. And so what have you found to be effective treatments?
Yeah, I mean, we have a whole host of things we try. And that's the important thing is no single treatment works. We have some that have much higher rates of response than others. But I would say our mainstays, our first line are things like low-dose naltrexone. We've found ivermectin to be hugely helpful. One part of this disease is something called mast cell activation. So we use things that are like mast cell stabilizers and or antihistamines, so H1 and H2 blockers. And then we also have to deal with microclotting. The patients who are really sick, they actually have blood clotting problems. They have a condition that we call microclotting, and many of them benefit from some amount of blood thinning strategies.
So did you say ivermectin is something you guys are using as a treatment that's been very effective?
Oh, yeah, first line, for sure. For sure. I would say 70% of our patients will have a positive response to ivermectin. Those responses can vary. Sometimes it's quite modest and sometimes they're really large. But yeah, that's the first thing that we start for sure.
So what do you think about these doctors who initially were against it? They were anti-ivermectin and they were saying this was not a feasible treatment, that just wasn't working.
What I think about them is that they've been misinformed. There was a disinformation campaign directed at ivermectin. And so, and disinformation has been used by industries for years. If you look at the tobacco industry, who invented it, the pharmaceutical industry practices it as well. And they really did not want ivermectin to be used. And there's some rather cynical reasons for that. One is that ivermectin, as well as other treatments like hydroxychloroquine, they threatened the emergency use authorization. You could not have supported that vaccine campaign if effective treatments had been identified. And so The drug has been really unfairly maligned, and it's a mainstay of our treatments, not only for acute COVID, but even here in long COVID and long backs.
So how does the spike protein impact these conditions? And are doctors and healthcare providers equipped on how to effectively treat these conditions?
No, it's such a good question. I mean, myself and all of my colleagues dealing with this, we are calling, there needs to be a new field that we call spikeopathy. The average doctor in the system is not being told that the spike protein is a pathogen. It is a cause of disease. And there's probably a good reason for that. They can't be taught that, because how can you be taught that and yet at the same time recommend vaccinations that are safe and effective that rely on producing spike protein? So spike protein is a pathogen. And we're learning many of the pathophysiologic mechanisms that it triggers, from, like I said before, microclotting to mast cells to autoimmunity, macrophage activation. It alters the microbiome, and it also hurts the mitochondria, which make, that's the energy forming units of the cell. We think that underlies a lot of the fatigue.
Dr. Pierre Corey, fascinating conversation here. Thanks so much for joining us. And we want to let our folks at home know that they can get more information and continue the conversation by tuning into the FLCCC's weekly webinar on Zoom and Rumble this Wednesday, February 21st at 7 p.m. That's Eastern Time. There's also an open Q&A session. So if you want to jump on there and ask some questions, you can go on. It's all free. Just go to flccc.net.
And we're glad you're here with us at FLCCC.net, our FLCCC weekly webinar. You know, welcome. I'm Betsy Ashton. I'm the creative director of this Alliance of Medical Professionals, scientists, and patients, and other good people, savvy people who support them. That was, of course, our Dr. Corey speaking earlier today to Jan Jeffcoat on a program called The National Desk that airs on Sinclair television stations throughout the nation. The National Desk is doing these new health update features with our doctors once a month, which takes our message to a much larger audience and enables our doctors to have real conversations and discuss topics that other news programs, newscasts will just not show, not allow. So we're very happy to have that extra exposure. And now, due to time zone issues, Pierre won't be with us live tonight here, but his favorite colleague and mentor, our esteemed chief scientific officer, Dr. Paul Marek, is going to be here, and he's going to give you more information on this whole long COVID, long backs issue that is confusing. He'll also tell you about updates that were just made, he just made, to the iRecover protocol that we have, and that deals with nothing but alleviating the suffering that so many, many former COVID patients and others who just got spike protein from so-called COVID vaccines are suffering. Also, Dr. Corey's partner in clinical practice, nurse practitioner Scott Marsland, will share with you what he and Pierre are seeing in the patients that have come to the clinic and what they've learned about how to improve their damaged health, whether caused by COVID infection or possibly by injection. We've got the medical experts here who don't shunt people aside, but do all they can to help. Now, we also have two top nurses already online to answer the questions that you type into Q&A anytime during the program. You can do that. And I'll bring some of those questions back to Paul and to Scott after their discussion. So Paul and Scott, come on out here. You know, tell us what you have learned that really, really does work, that helps in this situation.
So I must tell you that Pierre did an outstanding interview. And, you know, I'm not sure that there's anything we can add to it. So I think we've done the webinar because it really was an outstanding interview. So what we're going to do is I have a very brief PowerPoint, which is what I used at the conference. So I'm going to go through that quickly. And then Scott and myself are going to talk about long COVID and long vax, which is what we're talking about. So we're going to start off with definitions. So As Pierre said, long COVID, a prolonged illness after COVID-19, which may persist for months after the acute infection. Usually what happens with long COVID, patients recover, and then 2 to 3 weeks later start developing a whole host of symptoms. Long backs, there's a temporal correlation between receiving a COVID-19 vaccine and the beginning or worsening of clinical manifestations when the symptoms are unexplained by other concurrent causes. And this is important because patients may develop new symptoms that they don't really connect with the vaccine. So, you know, and we'll talk about these symptoms. And so one of the biggest problems is not, you know, associating the new onset of symptoms with the vaccine. So the symptoms, according to the NIH, almost anything can be attributed to long COVID. So this is a multi-system disease. And so this is important to emphasize that patients don't have one symptom. As Pierre said, this is a multi-system disease. So what's the difference between long vax and long COVID? Well, they're both due to spike disease. They're both due to a spikeopathy. As Pierre said, the spike protein is a pathogen, and long COVID and long vax are essentially caused by the spike protein. The bigger difference is with long vax, the amount of spike protein is significantly higher. And this may explain why patients with long vax tend to be sicker and why patients with long COVID tend to get better with time, although slowly, whereas patients with post-vax tend to persistent. There are some long COVID patients who have persistent pulmonary involvement from the acute illness. So that's one of the distinguishing features in long COVID. So patients may have, you know, organizing pneumonia, and that this may persist into the long COVID phase. And as Pierre said, there are enormous similarities with the chronic fatigue syndrome. So generally, there are numerous symptoms. The average is about 23. And so you can see they cover almost all the, as the NIH said, almost all the organ systems, respiratory, neurological, musculoskeletal, cardiovascular, autonomic, GI, dermatological, and mucous membranes. However, what's really important, as Pierre said, is that there are three symptoms that really stand out. And the most common is fatigue. At least 80% of patients complain of persistent fatigue that is new, debilitating. They don't have any energy, and they feel best when they lie down. The second, which is quite classic, is post-exertional malaise. So when patients try to exert themselves, their fatigue gets completely ramped up. It wipes them out. So they may do some exertion, and then following this for maybe even up to a week, they're completely fatigued, they have cognitive dysfunction, and are completely wiped out. And the third is brain fog, which is basically people have a cognitive deficit, which can be quite varied, you know, varying from word-finding difficulty to memory problems to trouble with concentrating, and in some cases, delusional and disorientation. So fatigue, post-exertional malaise, and brain fog are certainly the most common. And so, you know, how to approach these? You know, we obviously have developed monographs or protocols for the treatment, and patients who are interested should look at the iRecover for post-vaccine and iRecover for long COVID, on which there is much overlap. So we have updated the post-vax protocol, which I'll go into a little bit of detail. So, you know, the first thing always is intermittent fasting or periodic daily fasts. As Pierre said, ivermectin, although it sounds somewhat weird that we use ivermectin both for treatment of acute COVID as well as long COVID and long vax, the bottom line is that ivermectin binds to the spike protein. Apart from all its other modalities of action, it's been well demonstrated that ivermectin binds very strongly to the spike protein and may inhibit many of the hematological and other problems associated with spike and allow for spike to be eliminated. Moderate physical activity, so patients have to pace themselves. What's new and we'll talk about is there was a study looking at a randomized double-blind study looking at L-arginine and vitamin C, which we'll talk about. A new study, again, showing the benefit of low-dose naltrexone. We add nattokinase for a number of reasons. It's hematological benefits, as well as it breaks down spike. As Pierre said, treatment for mast cell activation. So this is the revised protocol, which is now available online. So as I said, there are two randomized studies now looking at arginine and vitamin C. They recommend a dose of arginine of 1.5 to 2 grams twice daily plus vitamin C. So probably they act synergistically. L-arginine increases nitric oxide, which increases microvascular perfusion. So it improves the perfusion. Vitamin C obviously is really important for wound healing. It's important for mitochondrial function. It's important for endothelial function. As Pierre said, many of these patients have evidence of mast cell activation. So this is the protocol for treatment of mast cell activation. What we now know is, interestingly enough, is the spike protein blocks cholinergic receptors. So that's the reason for using nicotine, which is a cholinergic agonist. And obviously, it affects the vagus nerve. So there is some data on the use of vagal nerve stimulation as well as nicotinic agonists in post-COVID patients. And there is some patients have reported a benefit with a nicotine patch. And then obviously there's the ARC microcurrent device, and Scott will talk about it. Scott's had significant positive results with this device, which goes onto the leg and results in microcurrents, which through a number of mechanisms appear to improve physiological function. So that was my quick little overview. Scott, you want to tell us what you're seeing in the field?
I would say that the farther along that we go, the more challenging it has become as far as vaccine injured patients, because the people who have been following the FLCCC and doing what they can, whether they're under the care of a provider or not, have been trying a lot of therapies and making some progress. And at this point, the people that we're seeing are people who've gotten one, two, or more boosters. And to your point that there's a difference between the spike from the virus and the spike from the shots, and there's a difference not just in qualitatively, but quantitatively, the more spike that people receive into their body, the more injury that there is, and the more time and effort and therapeutics it takes to help them get better.
Yeah. So, where do you start? You know, when a patient comes to you, where do you start? You know, do you go, you know, do you prescribe the whole complete list, or do you do a therapeutic trial and see how they respond? Do you titrate to symptoms? You know, how do you adjust the medication to each patient?
So, you know, on these days, I find that the first thing that I have to do is make sure that we don't have obstacles. To me, it feels like actually getting onto the field to play the game. And so I have to be very careful in my conversation with the patient to ask them, are you taking collagen? You know, a lot of people are taking collagen because their skin is saggy and wrinkly and their hair is falling out and their nails are soft. And so their chiropractor or their yoga instructor or their functional medicine doctor said, you need to take collagen. But the collagen actually activates and aggregates platelets, which exacerbates their microclotting. And I have to ask people if they're taking a proton pump inhibitor, you know, because people can get omeprazole over the counter. Sometimes they don't even think of it as a medication. But as you taught me back in July of 2022, the proton pump inhibitor is an incredible insult to the body because of how it does. It not only inhibits acid production in the stomach, but it inhibits acid production in the cells and blocks effective autophagy. People use over-the-counter antacids with aluminum, which can contribute to flocculation of the blood, and people are on statins. So right out of the gate, I feel like that's the mess that I have to clean up first to be able to have the conversation about, okay, what's next, right? Let's remove those obstacles first. And if we don't have to remove those obstacles, hallelujah, right? And so then, you know, I explain to people that in our practice, there's three fundamental therapies which we're using on almost every patient. It's like having a stool with three legs, right? It's ivermectin, low-dose naltrexone, and I'm going to say that the ARC microcurrent device is actually a third leg at this point. And you know, it's interesting to explain to patients that yes, this will be a plan based upon you individually. But because we have so much success of so many people with these three therapies, it's always worth trying, right? And I'm kind of bummed, Dr. Merrick, that even after all this time, with as much time and effort that the FLCCC has put in to spreading the word and sharing the protocols, that there's still a lot of providers in the community that don't get that you need to use the ivermectin for more than just a few weeks, right? That if someone's been boosted, right, it's going to take a while to clean up the spike. Their microclotting is going to persist, and the ivermectin helps with both. And so we saw that in the case studies at the conference, right? We saw these patients, and they weren't on ivermectin, and you're just kind of scratching your head like, well, that's kind of 0.0. The LDN just keeps on shining, right? Like now we have information about LDN and cancer. The webinar that UNPR did last week, where the esteemed physician from the UK was talking about how low-dose naltrexone decreases interleukin-6, the cytokine. That's always been a target of LDN, but it's also tightening up the junctions of the blood-brain barrier and tightening up the junctions of the gut. So those are shall I say something about the microcurrent at this moment?
Yeah.
Is that okay? The long story short about the microcurrent is so Pierre said, and you reiterated, there's three main common factors with vaccine injury: persistent fatigue and post-exertional malaise and brain fog. And as far as persistent fatigue and post-exertional malaise, the single most important thing that the microcurrent device does is it helps bring the mitochondria out of the cell danger response, phase 1, 2, or 3, so that the mitochondria start making ATP again. And the mitochondria have been profoundly disturbed by the spike protein. And this is an enormous boon to patients, right? I can almost say that for most of our patients that use this device, fatigue quickly becomes something of the past, which is quite remarkable, right? And I know there are different supplements in the arsenal to try and treat mitochondrial dysregulation, but to me that's like using a static intervention for a dynamic process, and the microcurrent is a dynamic intervention for a dynamic process. Additionally, it's profoundly anti-inflammatory. And it acts like something that influences genetic expression so that we see things in patients that I never knew were possible. I've never seen in 30 years. I see someone's ejection fraction improve from 40% to 55%, it having been damaged by the vaccine. Or I see someone with terrible joint and myalgia, muscle pain, have a dramatic improvement. And we also see improvement in anxiety and depression. We see improvement in bowel function. So those are the three therapies we start off with. And then the question I ask at the beginning of any visit is, so you have a list and you said on average, there's 23 symptoms for someone who's vaccine injured. I said, yes, you have a long list and I'm acknowledging all of them, but if you were to pick the top ones, what are the ones that have the most profound impact upon your daily function? And let's go after those first. And that's where I think the plan of care for a patient begins to be differentiated.
Yeah. So, you know, what I should have maybe mentioned right up front is that these wicked people who invented the spike really never came up with an antidote for the spike. So what we are doing, you know, us and our colleagues, is to try and develop therapeutic interventions that try and negate the damage done by the spike. Would you agree with that?
100%. And if they do have an antidote, they're sure not sharing it.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's not like we have a specific antidote. So that's why treatment can be somewhat frustrating, because there's no specific way of getting rid of spike. You know, we have to, you know, multiple mechanisms to interfere with the, you know, try to get rid of spike and to interfere with the pathophysiology. The other thing which is important, and hopefully Scott will agree, is there's no specific test. So many of these patients will go to, you know, a system doctor. They'll do a large battery of tests. The tests will come back as normal. And then I'll say, you see, there's nothing wrong with you. It's a functional disease. And so that is just so completely wrong, because most of the tests, almost all the tests, are negative. Would you agree with that, Scott?
I do. And the farther along that we go, I do think that there are some tests that we do which are clinically valuable. You know, most of the patients who come to see us have been tested up the wazoo, but spike antibody and microclotting are really valuable. I think that some of the tests that Jordan Vaughn has put forward that we use now, like PAI1, 4G, 5G, von Willebrand, Adam TS13, part of the value I see in using those tests is not only stratifying the coagulopathic risk of a patient, but also trying, hoping, thinking maybe someday we get to have a conversation with the system docs, because they may not believe that spike antibody or microclotting counts for anything, but they can go to the Mayo Clinic site and look up at PAI1, 4G, 5G and say, oh, that actually is a thing, right? Also, Dr. Gazda, I always say Gazda, but Dr. Gazda, has recommended for some time during serum neurofilament light chain, which is a general inflammatory marker for neurologic inflammation, and also the AD4240 detect, which is an indicator of whether or not someone has a higher risk for dementia. And I always reassure a patient before we do that test, I say, look, if this comes back that says you're at very high risk for dementia, it's not a sentence. But what it means is that we should really pivot and focus here. So there are tests which I do think guide our treatment, but it's also worth saying that, you know, doing this for the last 2 years of more than 4,000 patients, like, we've learned how to diagnose based on history and treat based on symptoms and evaluate for response to the therapeutics. That it's, when it comes down to it, You can treat the patient in that way, which is very practical.
I'd like to jump in here because there are some lot of questions and a lot of questions that want a little clarification on what you've just said. First of all, our people want to know, Tom in particular, which lab and what tests do you use to measure the level of spike protein in the blood?
So it is possible in a research setting to measure the spike in a person's body, but there's not a practical bona fide test available to civilians, I'll say, to measure spike. So we do use spike antibody. It's the IgG test from LabCorp in particular as an indirect measure, but it's imperfect because there are patients who have very elevated spike antibody levels and they're asymptomatic. But I'll tell you from what I see clinically that if someone has a spike antibody level above 25,000, they're, as my dad used to say, they're cruising for a bruising. They may not be symptomatic right now, but there's trouble that's probably going to pop up down the line.
We have another thing that you mentioned, collagen. I think everybody that watches is on collagen of some in some way. Would you clarify what the trouble is there and what is good and what is not good, what we need to know?
So collagen provides structure to life. It's like a three-dimensional scaffolding or ladder, right? And when your skin is supple and it goes back into shape, it's because collagen is providing structure. And as we get older and we get wrinkly and saggy, collagen's losing some of its tensility, right? Inside us, collagen provides basically springiness to blood vessels. So if you have a vein that gets compressed, the reason it can go back to that shape is because of collagen. The spike protein is damaging collagen. And the way that it influences collagen, it actually results in collagen being overbuilt. So the issue is not that we don't have enough collagen. The issue is that the collagen is overbuilt. So think of a ladder with a foot between the steps, right? You can intuitively, you can close your eyes and climb the ladder, no problem. But what if someone squished the steps? So now your ladder has steps like this, you can't climb it. And so right there, we should acknowledge that the issue is not that there is not enough collagen. The issue is that the collagen is overbuilt, right? When people take collagen out of this pre-pandemic idea that taking collagen is how you rejuvenate your nails, your hair, your skin, it's a mistaken notion. And then the really shocking piece to me is the bench scientists understand that if you're studying coagulopathy and you want to provoke platelets to aggregate and activate, you use liquid collagen. You apply collagen to the platelets, right? And part of how this came up in a clinical setting is three different patients in a row on their own started taking collagen. And they observed that the symptoms that they have that they associated with microclotting, whether it was severe headache, whether it was severe leg pain or chest pain, that it got worse. So then on their own, they recognized that and they stopped the collagen, right? So then farther down the line, I had two patients whose microclotting scores came back. And out of hundreds of patients, these were the first two patients whose levels did not get better over a 3 to 6 month period. And I'm scratching my head trying to figure out what's going on here. Why are these patients not getting better? And then when we dug into the chart, I found out, lo and behold, one patient was doping his coffee with collagen every morning. He was making a bowl of coffee, putting collagen in it. And the other patient had started supplementing with collagen because someone had suggested it. And at this point, I've got dozens of examples of this where, you know, there was a patient who was, she had been doing fabulously, better than she'd done in 2 years for 2 months. And then she dive bombed. And I feel like Agatha Christie, like trying to solve a mystery. I'm trying to figure out like, what did you do? And she started taking collagen. So I just wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Good heavens. Oh, okay. That was an education. All right.
So, Scott, since we're talking about collagen, I presume you don't have any problem with vitamin C.
No. Should I in relation to collagen?
Because you need vitamin C to make collagen. So, And vitamin C has been shown, you know, to improve endothelial function. So I think the idea of taking collagen seems like a bad idea.
Okay. But keep the vitamin C going.
Amen.
Yes.
All right. You know, Susan says here, I have high spike antibodies. Is there any evidence that the antibodies themselves can act as a pathogen?
I'll let Dr. Merrick take out.
Yeah, so that is a good question. There is some theory that the antibodies can act as anti-idiotype antibodies, actually, and can mimic the spike protein. But that's a little bit more controversial. And there's not much you can do about it anyway. Would you agree with that, Scott?
Yeah, I think that the value I place upon that test is the indirect measure. It's like using a mirror to look for the monster behind you. And more or less, sooner or later, as people are engaging in intermittent fasting, promoting autophagy, and taking therapeutics that help lower spike, we see the spike antibody level go down. And on the other hand, if you watch Dr. Gaz's presentations, you'll see mention of people who have spike antibody levels that are 25,000, greater than 25,000. Like, it's been my observation in conversation with Dr. Gaz that the patients whose spike antibody levels are very high are much more likely to end up being her patients because they develop neurodegenerative conditions. So it's my job to try and catch them early and keep that from happening.
Yeah, so I think Scott is right. It's not a direct, ideally we would want to measure spike in the blood, and this could be done commercially, but they don't want people to do this. So we have to use the antibody as a surrogate. And so basically it's telling you about the body's immune response to the spike protein. So it is an indirect marker of the amount of spike protein. And obviously we know that you make autoantibodies. So that's why when you have all of these, antibodies, the likelihood is you may have autoantibodies, you may have anti-idiotype antibodies. It's very difficult to separate them out. But the fact that you have high levels of antibodies is a bad thing. It means that the host is responding to the spike protein.
And I think over time, what will become clearer, but what I see from my front row seat, is that when patients have a very high level of spike antibody and continue unabated, they have a tendency to kind of go up over, it's like they go up over a mountain, come down, and on the other side, they begin to look like they're making autoantibodies against their nervous system. And then we start to see degenerative neurological conditions that mimic MS, that mimic Parkinson's, that mimic dementia. And I'm careful in choosing those words to say mimic, because with proper treatment, we're often able to pull those people back from those things. And when they've gone to their neurologist, the neurologist is like, yeah, well, you look like you have Parkinson's, but I don't think you have Parkinson's.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think Scott is right, is that, if you have high levels of antibodies, the likelihood is you're going to have autoantibodies, anti-idiotype antibodies, or all kinds of, other cross-reacting antibodies. So I think, the lower the better. And if therapy lowers the antibody level, I think you're going on a good trajectory.
Yeah.
All right. I want to go back to the test. Now, I think you said there's so few tests. But Ellen wanted to be a little more specific and asks, are there any lab tests that can see if histamine mast cell activation is an issue?
Yeah, there's a book I can recommend called Never Bet Against Occam, written by Dr. Lawrence Afrin. He is the eminent world expert on mast cell activation. And I think it's actually a funny book. He has a good sense of humor. And you know, I think it's beyond the scope of this webinar to go into those tests, but because it's actually quite complicated, and it's still an evolving field. Like a decade ago, there were scientists and physicians who thought he was being precocious and premature writing that book. So I'll shut up. I hope that's the answer to the
question. I mean, there is, Scott, what do you think of measuring blood histamine or tryptase levels?
So I do measure histamine and I do measure tryptase levels in some patients, but I think Dr. Afrin does a good job of discussing the limitations of that testing. But on the topic of mast cell activation, you know, my self-assigned homework traveling to the FLCCC conference and back was to read Dr. Afrin's very dense book and chapter. And reflecting upon the patients that we've seen over the last 2 years, I'm really struck by how profoundly involved mast cell activation is in most of the patients that we see. And that comes down to the way that the spike protein has hyperactivated the mast cells, like masts of a ship in our body. And mast cells are like these prehistoric creatures. They last 2 to 4 years, whereas white blood cells last a week, right? So the fact that the spike protein is having a profound impact upon our mast cells tells you, like, this is like a 2 to 4 year dance that we're looking at. Lotus naltrexone is the initial salvo that we have to try and stabilize mast cells. But Dr. Merrick had a list of other things like chromalin and ketotifen, singulair, histamine one, histamine two. There's a lot that can be done to try and ameliorate people's symptoms from the mast cell perspective.
Going back to the basics now, because there is confusion out there. And I think the answer is, this would be a true long COVID case, but Jennifer wants clarification. Are there any long COVID patients who never had a COVID jab?
Yeah.
And that would be true.
It's a good question. I mean, most 80% of the population have been jabbed, but certainly you can get long COVID without being vaccinated. The problem is when you're vaccinated and you have symptoms of long COVID, it becomes complicated. And so the worst thing that a patient with long COVID can do is be vaccinated, because it's your cumulative spike load that determines symptoms. But certainly you can develop long COVID without being jabbed.
All right. Now, this is a question for you, Scott. Susan Vonk asks, is baobab?
Or hi, Susan.
Is it baobab or do you say baobab? How do you say it? Baobab?
You say tomato, I say tomato. Let's call the whole thing off.
All right. Susan wants to know, is it like a food where it isn't really dose dependent? I like the taste, she says, and love sipping on it, wondering if it interferes with triple coags, and can I take more than one tablespoon when feeling a need for more antioxidants?
Okay, so I think the question is, the questions are, is it dose dependent and can I take more? Is that it in a nutshell?
Yeah.
And does
Before Scott answers, let me just intervene and say, so there's not a lot of published literature on baobab. So, you know, the protocol is restricted to, interventions for which there is some supporting data. But that doesn't mean that, you know, the clinical expertise of the clinician is important. And so this is where the baobab comes in. You know, it's not listed as first-line therapy because there's not a lot of literature. But I think Scott can tell us about his, you know, his observational data on the use of baobab. And certainly it can't do any harm.
It's a very interesting looking tree too. That's all I know. Right.
So there's 7 grams of fiber in a tablespoon of baobab. And there are tribes people in Africa who basically drink the equivalent of 100 grams of fiber worth of baobab over a day. It does appear to have a dose-dependent relationship. I'll tell you that when I had to travel to the FLCCC conference and back, instead of doing a tablespoon and 16 ounces of water a day, I bumped it up to 4 in 2 Nalgene bottles over the course of the conference, and it helped me sail through it.
So this is something you do regularly.
It is. I my perspective on it, because of the EGCG, which Dr. Merrick has written about extensively about EGCG in relation to cancer, there are studies, and that's probably where there's more solid footing here, right? There's multiple studies around EGCG in green tea and how EGCG blocks spike entry into cells. So there is EGCG, which is epigallocatechin gallate, in green tea, and there's EGCG in baobab. And I think that's probably the active ingredient. Now, in relation to, if I just stick with that, EGCG, EGCG has been shown through the COX-1 pathway to inhibit platelet aggregation. So in plain terms, what that means is, just like aspirin can help with clotting issues, EGCG can help with clotting issues, but it's actually been shown it's 90% effective compared to aspirin being like 20% effective. So it certainly does not interfere with anticoagulation treatment. In fact, it helps in a very safe way. There really aren't bleeding issues that I'm aware of. Dr. Merrick, are you aware of any bleeding issues of EGCG?
No, I think you're absolutely correct, Scott. So, you know, baobab seems to have many benefits, and it may be the ECGC, which has been shown, as you say, very specifically to block spike protein, so that the getting into the cell. So that's how it may work. And obviously also working through COX-1. So, you know, you choose your poison, choose how you want to get ECGC. You know, you want to get it through green tea, you want to get through green tea supplements, you want to get it through baobab, you know. And so people are asking, what is ECGC? It's the active compound in green tea. You want to tell us its name, Scott? It's a real long mouthful.
Epigallocatechin gallate.
Yes, he can say it pretty well.
And how is that tribe that is, you know, overdosing on baobab? How are they doing? I mean, are they the most healthy people on the planet?
They have some of the most amazing poop and one of the most diverse microbiomes of anybody on the planet. And that would be one of the tremendous arguments of choosing baobab over other options, because it has a prebiotic fiber that helps modulate glucose metabolism. You know, we see the impact of the spike protein on the pancreas, moving people from prediabetes into diabetes and exacerbating diabetes. So I've seen people's fasting glucose drop 10 points in a month with baobab sipping. It works both ways in terms of bowel function. If people have diarrhea, baobab can help basically tame the diarrhea. If people have constipation, they end up having lovely, comfortable, formed bowel movements because of the baobab. So, and bifidobacterium is abundant in the guts of people that sip baobab, and bifidobacterium is very protective.
And if people don't know what baobab is, actually, it's a very unusual looking tree with a very, very broad based trunk that grows in Africa. It's an African tree, and it has these particular fruits. Right. So, Scott, where do people get their baobab from? Obviously, they're not traveling to Africa.
Not in the backyard.
Right. So I don't have any financial interest in these companies. There's a company called Trim Healthy Mama, which makes a plain baobab. They call it Baobab Boost. And there's a company called TIGA, T-I-G-A, which is probably your better bet, because they recognize that the taste of baobab doesn't jive with most Americans' palates. So they figured out flavors, and they figured out some modifications of it that make it easier to mix into a drink. So TIGA, TIGA.
All right. Oh, we have so many good questions here. Now let's, we got to get on with them. Aaron has serious issues and needs your advice. I've been disabled with extreme fatigue since the J&J shot in late 2021. I used to get a few weeks of energy from antiparasitics such as wormwood, black walnut hull, golden seal, etc. But the newfound energy stops after a few weeks. I slowly stopped responding at all with any antiparasitics, even ivermectin. And now nothing seems to be working. Why do you think I stopped responding? Perhaps my spike protein load is now under control and there are now other issues from my vaccine injury? I mean, obviously you can't do a whole workup with somebody in one question, so that's hard to answer, but can you help at all?
Dr. Merrick, take a whack and then I'll take a whack.
Yeah, you know, I think you should never give up. And, you know, if one intervention doesn't work, I think you want to try something different. You know, there's really good data on arginine and vitamin C, so I would consider that. And then I think in combination, so, you know, the problem with ivermectin, as Pia said, is, you know, the treatment of acute COVID is ivermectin for 5 days. The treatment for long vax is ivermectin for almost indefinite, just because you have to get rid of the spike. So, you know, I would, ivermectin is so safe. It is such a safe compound that, so I would start again with ivermectin, maybe increase the dose with arginine, vitamin C, low dose naltrexone. And I think it's often the combination of therapeutic approaches that may help. There's no single magic bullet. Would you agree with that, Scott?
100%. And what else I would say is you may be expecting more of the antiparasitics than you should. And I'm really glad that you saw benefit from them. When you talk about fatigue or you talk about lack of energy, I think you need to consider mitochondrial function, and you need to consider mast cell activation. So Dr. Merrick has talked quite a bit about near-infrared light, getting out in the sun, photobiomodulation. Like, that's
free. No, I was just going to intervene there because, in fact, there is a study, a published peer-reviewed paper looking at near-infrared for brain fog. I think it's done at the University of West Virginia, showing that near-infrared, either using a helmet or a bed, significantly improved brain fog. So that's something else to consider. And some of these near-infrared lamps are not that expensive. But so I think the bottom line is there's no single intervention. It's probably a combination of different interventions. And I think the more symptomatic the patient is, the more diverse the intervention has to be.
Yep.
Here's a question from someone who was paying attention at the conference. It's from Anonymous. He says, at the conference, Scott presented spike antibody numbers of patients in regards to shedding after the most recent booster rollout. And then he asks, can you clarify what blood test my doctor can order that will show my spike antibody count? Is it the one you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, it's by LabCorp, and it's a SARS-CoV-2 antibody. It's an IgG.
All right.
And the range is from 0.8 to greater than 25,000.
Here's another question from Robert. Says, my wife is affected by long vax. She feels better when she takes ivermectin. I'm going to start her on a daily regimen. The FLCCC writes that it's difficult to wean people off ivermectin without a return to symptoms. What is causing this? Is ivermectin just binding to the spike temporarily and not getting it out of the body? Should it be paired with a binder to get rid of the spike?
You want to take that one, Scott?
My observation is that ivermectin is directly neutralizing spike in the body. And I'm going to say, unfortunately, I've had dozens of patients who've gone down the route of quote-unquote binders, like taking EDTA infusions. And you know, that's where the variety of opinion out there on the internet gets hard to negotiate. And I generally, what I've seen is those patients have seen no benefit or gotten worse. So I don't subscribe to the notion that people need binders.
I would agree with Scott 100%. So, I mean, I think the ivermectin binds to the spike protein. So at the same time, you need to do other interventions to help get rid of the spike. You know, intermittent fasting is really important, and dietary interventions to help trigger autophagy. I think nattokinase may be good in that it helps break down spike protein. I think bromelain is useful. It breaks down spike protein. So green tea or ECGC, however you get it, prevents the spike getting into the cells. So I think that it's a recipe. It's like baking a cake. You can't just use one ingredient. There are multiple ingredients. And the goal is, with time, the spike load will decrease. So therefore, you'll be able to decrease slowly the dose of ivermectin as one's load of spike protein decreases. Would you agree, my friend Scott?
I would, although in the current climate, because of the potency that we've seen reflected from the boosters that is only a small percent of people are getting, I don't intend to counsel my patients to set aside ivermectin anytime soon, because it is...
Whoops.
It looks like Scott just froze a little bit.
Yeah.
So we know that you can take ivermectin at pretty high doses for pretty prolonged periods of time. So, you know, it is a very safe intervention. And so, you know, as Scott is saying, and we seem to have...
Okay, there you are.
I don't know. I just moved around. There are concerns raised by some practitioners about the negative impact upon the microbiome. I would say that's another argument for using baobab, because it's not on the protocol. This is me speaking as a clinician about what I see with patients, that when we do stool testing, they actually have decent levels of bifidobacterium, despite having been on ivermectin for like 2 years. So I find the concerns or the claims that long-term use of ivermectin eliminates bifidobacterium, I find those to be specious claims. I just don't find them to be verified in the testing of the GI tract that we do.
I'd like to, you know, it's 8 o'clock here, and it would be good if we could go a little bit longer. How are you guys good with that?
You could do a few minutes, yeah.
Okay, very good. We've had a number of people who say that what can be done for those who have long-term loss of taste and smell after having COVID, and also menstrual problems, probably from a vaccine. Is there anything for them?
There's a battery of interventions that I usually go through with people that have persistent loss of taste and smell. The first thing I usually try is high dose ivermectin, so 0.6 milligrams per kilogram for 3 days. And if that doesn't work, I try it again for 3 days. And then I also try EPA, which is a type of fish oil, but it's a it's a particularly concentrated. And I do, I work up to 4,000 milligrams or 2,000 twice a day. Do that for a week or so. And if that doesn't work, there is oxytocin, which Dr. Gaz is a big fan of, calls it the love drug or the love hormone. You can get oxytocin compounded. And I know some patients have done taste retraining. I've seen that help a few people, but I don't think that we have failed yet to help bring back taste and smell. It takes longer in some people than others. But if we, when we've kept at it, we've been able to get it back. Those are just three things off the top of my head. Dr. Merrick, can you?
Yeah. So, you know, Betsy, on our I Recover vaccine injury protocol, we have specific therapies, you know, general therapies, then we have specific therapies, which do include loss of taste and smell. So I would recommend people, you know, go to the website and download the updated protocol.
And what was the other thing you mentioned, Betsy? There was a second part
to the question. Menstrual abnormality.
Right. You know, I found all of my patients with menstrual abnormalities have responded to ivermectin. We have, in some cases, had to increase the dose. But that's actually, there isn't a single patient that we've had that hasn't helped correct that.
Question from KM Texas says, LDN gives me headache, exhaustion, nightmares, and more pain for small fiber neuropathy. Have tried it 3 times, can't get past one drop for 5 days. Is this a Herx reaction? Or what can this person do?
I don't know that that's a Herx reaction. And there is a small number of patients that can't tolerate it. The one thing that I would ask is whether or not you've used ultra low dose naltrexone. So we actually, and Pierre laughs at me because he says, well, that's homeopathy, Scott. But we do sometimes ask the compounding pharmacy to make low dose naltrexone 1 milligram per ml. So when you take a single drop, it ends up being like 0.01 milligrams. I mean, it is a very, very tiny dose, but believe it or not, I do have a few patients that have gotten clinical benefit from such a low dose.
Agree with Scott is that, you know, maybe this patient should reduce the dose even further, use very low dose 0.1, and then slowly increase the dose as tolerated. Some patients do seem to benefit from very low dose.
All right. Do you have any recommendations for children with long COVID symptoms?
I think the FLCCC has very rich resources under the expert stewardship of Dr. Liz Mumper. And the best thing to do would be to go to those resources at the website.
All right. Laura would like to know more about the microcurrent device. How often do your patients use the device? For how long? Is there a favorite location on the body to affix the device?
So the device has 4 programs. The minimum amount of time that someone would use the first program typically is 45 minutes. It's 4 45-minute cycles in the first program. Dr. Merrick and I have conferred around a group of patients that didn't do well with the device to try and troubleshoot, to learn about that. And one of the things that we learned is that people can introduce it extremely slowly if they have challenges with it. Like they can literally do a minute today, 2 minutes tomorrow, 3 minutes the next day. But in general, I would say 95% of our patients tolerate it very well right out of the gate. They use it for a minimum of 3 hours because a cycle is 3 hours. And it tends to be something that people can do as many as 5 cycles a day. And the more they do it, the more benefit they get. The 3 places where a person wears it typically are on the upper arm, on the leg above the calf, or down by the ankle. And I have had patients who've used a binder and wrapped it around their abdomen. But it's a systemic, the benefit is systemic. So it doesn't matter as much where you put it as that you have a good connection.
Yeah, most patients use it on around the ankle. It seems easiest to apply. So it just wraps around the you know, just above the ankle.
I have a question from Rebecca, and this is, we have heard about a self-replicating COVID vaccine just approved in Japan. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so this is a really bad idea. So if the mRNA was a bad vaccine, the self-replicating is a monstrously bad idea. So basically, what the vaccine does is it has messenger RNA, which codes for the spike protein, and then it has messenger RNA, which codes for a protein which replicates the messenger RNA. So the body becomes a factory, both for messenger RNA, which makes the spike, as well as spike. It's a Frankenstein kind of a vaccine. It's, if you were going to think about the worst kind of vaccine to possibly make, because it's going to cause a massive amount of spike protein, and we're not sure how it's going to switch off. So somehow it got approved in Japan, but I can tell you it's going to arrive here pretty soon. It's a Frankenstein kind of a vaccine.
That's terrifying.
It's scary. It's called its name speaks for itself, a self-amplifying messenger RNA vaccine.
And the problem that you've been dealing with and seeing is this spike protein that replicates enough, you know, that's causing enough problems. And now you want something that's going to take that to the 10th degree or worse. Good Lord. Whose brilliant idea was that?
Yeah, well, this is big. This is the pharmaceutical industry. You know, what they're trying to do is it makes no sense, because we know spike is a pathogen. And so this is a vaccine which makes a lot of spike. So the benefit they've shown is it causes quite a profound antibody response, which is what you would expect if you make a lot of spike protein. It's awful. It's an awful concept.
We can't leave them on that note. I mean, we have to do something. We have to have an upbeat. We do have, I have a few good things in the announcements to tell people in the end about good works that you have done and updates that you have done, so, and health things. So maybe we'll have to leave it there and say thank you to the two of you for helping make people well.
And thank you, Scott. I think that was a good discussion. You know, it's a very complicated subject. You know, it's very difficult. You know, we know how to treat a myocardial infarction. You know, we know how to treat diabetes. To treat spike-related disease, it's probably the most challenging disease there is.
Thank you.
This was great fun to be on tonight with both of you. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you.
Great to see you. I have a few announcements, and we have a great, great, great video at the end. So don't go away. Don't go away. Let me call up my notes here so I can find out where I am. All right. Yes, we had updates. It's hard to believe we've been doing this for 4 years now. But we have so many new things that just kind of keep popping up, new vital information to share. So here we are, keep telling you about it. And we were glad you were able to join us in this discussion tonight. As you learned, there have been some new updates to the iRecover post-vaccine treatment guide, which you see on your screen. So please make sure to read and download the new version on the link here, or you can use the QR code. It's all there. Now then, just because the show is almost over doesn't mean that the conversation has to be. If you have questions or comments, or you just want to keep the conversation going, head over to the new FLCCC forums, the only place where we can speak openly and honestly about, well, you know, all of the health topics and more without fear of being censored or deplatformed. It is a great way to meet new people, share information, learn, grow, and build community, all without the worry of censorship. So visit flccc.net/forums today to learn more, or, you know, just register now and get started. Now, something else wonderful we've got for you. We have a new health guide covering over 20 things, daily things that you can do to take control of your health and to improve your well-being. From some basic lifestyle changes to must-have supplements to tips for stress management, you know, you don't want to miss it. It's good stuff. Please make sure to share this with all of your friends and family too, as we all need to be our healthiest selves now when God knows what's coming at us next. That thing from Japan just, woo. Anyway, perhaps more than ever before, we need this. So you can find it on our website under the Tools and Guides tab or at the link on the screen. Ah, we have some fun new designs in our online store just in time for spring. Yes, spring is about to happen. It really is around the corner, and you can find these along with many other fun gifts for the FLCCC family members in your life at supportflccc.store. Make sure to use the code LETDOCTORSBEDOCTORS to, you know, get your 10% off when you check out your order. And with that, let's bring on our nurses. Christina Morrows is the woman behind these designs, and Samantha Hanks, who is with it. They've been answering questions, and I bet have been very busy tonight with lots of questions. How did it go?
We had lots of questions. We had like 200 questions. We got to maybe a third of them. A lot of them were the same question over and over, though. So I think when people rewatch the video, they'll probably have their questions answered when they see it tomorrow.
Well, thank you very much. We really appreciate your being here and doing that. And we thank you, folks. You know, the final thing we have to do is, you know, we've been discussing COVID for nearly 4 years. And that means we have been building our FLCCC army, our FLCCC family for 4 years too. We have grown and evolved, and so has our mission. And all of this has been possible because you have helped us at every step along the way. We truly appreciate each and every one of you. Thank you for helping us do what we do. We will see you next week, same time, same place, but don't touch the dial, not yet. This short video that is coming up is a great My Story. It was told at our Phoenix conference. It's one you don't want to miss. You want inspiration? Watch Paul Mann tell his story.
I'm Paul Mann, and this is my story. June 3rd, 2022, I was diagnosed with advanced stage 4 prostate cancer. It had, by the time it was detected, it had spread across my pelvis, up my spine, across the ribs, across the shoulders, my sternum, down my right leg, down my right arm, and along my skull. I was told on the very day I was diagnosed that I was well beyond any kind of surgery, and they put me on radiation the next day, started radiation treatments, started chemo treatments the week after that. I had a total of 10 radiation treatments to my right sacrum, 2 radiation treatments to my sternum, 1 radiation treatment to my left scapula, and then 6 rounds of chemotherapy. During that time, several times, I was put into hospice twice. They thought I was going to go. I kind of thought I was going to go. I just kept waking up. After, at the meeting, the oncologist, right before the last chemotherapy, I was asking about what was next. And he told me this wasn't curative. And he's like, you're completely full, very advanced, very aggressive cancer. There is no curative. At some point, one or more of your organs is going to have too much cancer in it to continue functioning, and you'll have a series of organ failures. I was like, well, that's not fun. And he's like, no, that's not fun at all. After they finished their treatments, you're kind of left on your own. A month or so after that, I'd been in a hospice again. They thought I was going. But I just kept waking up every morning. About a month after that last chemotherapy infusion, I got in contact with Dr. Reddy. And I had some questions about why I can't get more treatments. She explained all that. And she mentioned, you know, there's some studies that show that ivermectin might be beneficial in fighting cancer. You have nothing to lose. You might as well try ivermectin. So I found a place in Tennessee. I live in St. Louis. I found a place in Tennessee I could drive to and buy it over the counter. I go down there every 3 months to buy some ivermectin. And 18 months later, I'm still here. I'm functioning. I go to work. I go out dancing a couple times a week. And it seems like things are on the upswing. I'm still full of cancer, but two of the tumors have resolved. The others have stopped growing. I get a next scan in about 4 more months. We'll see then the results of how the ivermectin is behaving. And hopefully some more have resolved by then, and I'll be on the upswing rather than the downward spiral. So I'm Paul Mann, and that's my story.
Your stories are powerful. They change hearts and minds. Share yours today. Send it in to mystory@flccc.net.